Welcome to the Resilience Roundup podcast. I am your host, Lataria Walker. The Army can be a tough profession. Mix in additional responsibilities like leading troops, attending college, maintaining a home, parenting, keeping up with finances, basically living life. How can we successfully manage everything? How can we not just cope, but learn, grow, and thrive? Resilience. That's it. Resilience is the ability to persevere, adapt, and grow in dynamic or stressful environments. Resilience encompasses internal motivation, persistence, and how soldiers revitalize, recover, and adapt in order to respond constructively to challenges in their daily lives. Training and education empowers leaders and soldiers to demonstrate resilience. When individuals gain experience in applying these skills, it enables cohesive team building and drives readiness. The Resilience Roundup podcast is a place where you can find resources that will help you maintain your resilience. You are resilient. Welcome to the Resilience Roundup podcast, episode 11. I am Lataria Walker, your podcast host. Today, our guest is Mr. Alejandro Palacios, a victim advocacy training manager at the National Organization for Victim Assistance, also known as NOVA. This episode's topic is ethical practices and responsibilities in the advocacy world. Mr. Palacios will delve deeply into what ethics are and why they are important. He will also highlight how our personal and professional ethics require honesty and transparency and an awareness of ethical conflicts of interest, as well as of confidentiality and informed consent. In addition, he will share how our personal morals help us determine good versus bad, and how our belief systems are constructed through our community. Mr. Palacios, thank you for joining us today, sir. Please tell us a bit more about yourself.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to participate in this podcast, so I really appreciate the time. So let me tell you just a little bit about myself. You mentioned I'm the victim advocacy training manager with NOVA. I've been doing this for close to 2 years now. Prior to that, I was lead advocate of the Victim Offender Dialogue Program at the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitations, and Reentry Office of Victim Services, in which some of my other roles were ensuring that victims were notified of death, release, escapes, which thankfully didn't have, also assisting individuals who have been impacted by crimes to exercise their victims' rights to participate in any hearing in which their offender or abuser had a right to be present, amongst others rights that victims and survivors have in Arizona. Prior to that, I was a technology safety specialist with the National Network to End Domestic Violence as part of their Safety Net project, which we educated advocates, caseworkers, law enforcement, and others, individuals in the advocacy world, around the issues of technology and abuse. Prior to that, I also was a trainer with the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence for 3 years, through which I had the opportunity and the privilege to train Department of Social Services, caseworkers, advocates, as well as law enforcement agencies throughout the state of Arizona. Prior to that, I had the honor of being a lay legal advocate at a local domestic violence shelter here in the city of Phoenix, in which I provided assistance, support, safety planning for those who had experienced and fled domestic violence.
Wow, what a pretty impressive career. Thank you for your commitment to this line of work. I mean, that's sheer commitment and passion that I hear there. Thank you for that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's begin our discussion. Can you share with us what victim advocacy is and why it's important?
Of course. Thank you. And I think that is a great question to start with. Victim advocacy are trained individuals to serve those who have experienced crime, trauma, or adversity. And not only those directly impacted, but also provide support, information, referrals to their support networks, such as their friends, their families, also when there's children and minors involved, refer them to the appropriate services and educate them around different processes that the family or individual could potentially have to go through. And this happens regardless of the crime or the adversity that the person experienced, or even if the crime was reported or not, when we're talking about a specific crime. A victim survivor working with a victim advocate can expect to be provided with different options, you know, regarding reporting, safety, take into account their physical and emotional safety, their healing process, which may take some time, as well as attaining and knowing what resources are available to them locally, probably within their state, or even at a national level, and many more options that they may have when it comes to what services the family might need.
Wow. So how does this victim advocacy tie into ethics?
This is very important because when we, as victim advocates, are in the process of assisting individuals who may be experiencing worse trauma or the worst adversity that they had thought or have never thought that they were experienced, we need to be very cautious about how we are assisting them. Ethics play a crucial role in victim advocacy because, as advocates, we must adhere to high moral and a set of professional standards while providing services to those that need of the services that we can provide as individuals and the services that our agencies can provide and how we must assist them. There are, though, with this, some key ethical principles that need to be taken into account, such as the principle of confidentiality. That's of utmost importance, as well as boundaries, informed consent, and even self-care for advocates. Those, I think, are the top principles that we should take into account. Confidentiality, because we need to not only understand, but also educate those that we serve on how their information will be protected. Boundaries is important because we need to understand that we should always strive for maintaining the relationships professional. Because we are human beings, we interact, we are social individuals, and we need to keep in mind that when we are providing services, when we are advocating on behalf of others, those relationships cannot be at that point in time way more than strictly professional. Now, in regards to informed consent, that is key because those that we serve need to understand if we are sharing specifics about their information, their cases, and who are we sharing that information with, and the reason for why we are sharing that information. And it's all about educating them about informed consent and self-care. Last but definitely not least, because you cannot pour from an empty cup. In order to be the best advocates that we can, we need to care for ourselves. We need to do whatever that works for us to re-energize when you have time to take care for yourself physically, emotionally, and in other ways in order to be fully present when assisting those in need. That being said, ethics play a very positive impact in the quality of services that are provided to those who experience crime, adversity, and trauma. Those in crisis who have experienced trauma and adversity need of victim advocates who understand the ethics surrounding victim advocacy so we can empower them and assist them and guide them to make the best decision that's best for them and for their families.
Wow, that's a great answer. And it's an exceptional segue into my next question, because you did mention professional standards. So let's talk a bit about that. How are professional ethical standards even set?
That's a great question. And you know, in the victim advocacy world, since the 1960s, the field of victim advocacy has been evolving into becoming a profession. And that includes setting a set of standards, but also training requirements and obtaining certifications. And all of this stems from the individuals who early on started advocating on behalf of others, who noticed and became aware of different situations that came across with the profession and that needed to be taken into account, and that information needed to be shared amongst the professions, amongst the profession and the professionals, in order to continue evolving and professionalizing the practice of victim advocacy. And with setting a set of standards, you can think about the NACP, which is a National Advocate Credentialing Program that basically certifies individuals who have been through a 40-hour victim advocacy training. And they can, with that, attain further and continuous education, because of victim advocates, as it relates to ethics, it is of utmost importance to be as informed, as trained, and as knowledgeable as possible.
Great. So let's switch gears a bit. And you mentioned conduct before, and I want to revisit that. What is the proven principle of conduct?
So the proven principle of conduct includes general principles that are commonly considered fundamental to ethical behavior in victim advocacy. And some of those that I can think right off the top of my head are integrity, respect, responsibility, in order to be fully present and capable when assisting those in need. And those are part of ethical practices that we should all take into account, which, those being said, I also like to mention honesty and transparency, being fully honest in regards to what we can do and how ourselves as advocates or our agencies can assist those in need. And when there are services that ourselves or agency cannot provide, letting them know that at this point our agency cannot do this, or we cannot do this for them. However, we can connect them to those agencies, to those individuals who may be able to assist them with their needs, as well as respecting the human rights of every single individual that we work with, including those, you know, that we may disagree with. And that being said, also to never engage in any discriminatory practices.
Wow. Let's delve a bit more into ethical practices. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So ethical practices are a set of recommendations, if you will, in regards to understanding our role as advocates as it relates to ethics, so we can assist those who require our services to the very best of our abilities. And some ethical practices that I like to talk about is, for example, confidentiality. As advocates, we must strive to protect the confidentiality of those that we serve, especially in including their personal identifying information, because we need to remember this. We are trusted as advocates with very sensitive information. Some other point that I like to mention in regards to ethical practices would be the respect for diversity. And by that, I mean that as advocates, we must respect the diversity of perspectives and experiences within the communities that we work. As advocates, we should seek to amplify the voices of those who have been marginalized and ensure that our work is inclusive and equitable Because we might get to a point as victim advocates when we're advocating on behalf of an individual or a family, and we present them with a set of options. And we have an opinion in regards to what could potentially be their best options, or maybe they do the total opposite, or they decide to go another route. Based on their experience and their diversity of perspective, we may not agree, but that is okay because we need to understand that they are the experts in their own lives. Another ethical practice that I think of is of extreme importance is collaboration and partnership. I always like to talk about striving to collaborate, to partner with different governmental, not governmental organizations and agencies, because there's no single individual nor agency that can do it all. But we all have a common objective, which is to assist those in need. And we should be open to learning from each other, to sharing the knowledge and connecting ourselves to other resources.
Wow, that's very powerful. So let's talk a bit about decision-making. You know, that's a part of our everyday lives. We all make decisions all day long. What are we going to have for dinner? You know, where are we going to go on vacation? What TV show are we going to watch? So decisions are a very important part of what we do every day. But tell us, what are common barriers to ethical decision-making?
That's a great question. I appreciate you bringing that into the conversation. And I like to address this particular question by mentioning that ethical decision-making becomes a skill with time and practice. It's not always that straightforward. Some of the potential barriers, and I talk from my experience, my individual experience as a victim advocate, and I can definitely say that a potential barrier to ethical decision-making could be a lack of training or lack of information by individual in regards to what are those ethics that relate to advocacy. Potentially, and over the years as a trainer, I've heard that in several cases, there's not much institutional or agency support, which limits or sets a barrier for an individual to make or to understand ethical decisions. Now, individuals or organizations potentially may hold conflicting values, making it difficult to decide which value to prioritize in a given situation, which this can definitely lead to ethical dilemmas where there might be no clear right or wrong answer, which may then set a barrier in and of itself for an individual to decide what is the best decision for those that we are serving. Another potential barrier to an ethical decision can be a potential conflict of interest. I also like to mention that emotions such as fear, anger, anxiety, which are very normal emotions that we as individuals have the capability of feeling. However, when we are feeling those, we may be going through any of those. Those can cloud our judgment and make it difficult to make rational, ethical decisions, which can lead not only individuals, but also organizations to make choices that may not be consistent, you know, with their ethical practices.
So when are those practices most effective?
Those practices are most effective when we are aware and conscious of what our role is, and when we have an understanding that we need to prioritize in any given situation what's best for those that we serve. Not our personal or cultural values, but what's best for those individuals that need the services that we are providing. It's what I like to say, it's always putting victims and survivors first.
So let's talk more about victim advocates. I feel like everybody should be, you know, a victim advocate. I'm not a trained one, but I feel like I certainly am a victim's advocate, and I have been at, you know, different situations in life. Tell us what the ethical responsibilities are of victim advocates, and even talk a bit about who is a victim advocate.
A victim advocate can be any individual who provides services to those who have experienced crime. Now, as it relates specifically to victim advocates, there are specific statutes by different states that required individuals to take, per se, I know right at the top of my head, in Arizona, a victim advocate is required per statute to take a 40-hour training. And this is very important because once an individual is protected, if you will, under the victim advocacy statute, any conversation that this person may be having with a victim for crime is protected, as that conversation is confidential, and it's also a privileged communication, which protects information from potential disclosure, which from experience, I can say that when there's a disclosure of information, it may have, unfortunately, a negative impact on a victim or a survivor when they did not consent or were not advised or informed of that potential disclosure. So one of the other very important aspects of the ethical practices and responsibilities that we have as individuals, as advocates, is the fact that as advocates, we must be accountable for the impact of our actions and ensure that our activities and our actions do not have unintended negative consequences. We should hold ourselves accountable and responsible for the positive impact that we may have on an individual's family, but also when unfortunately there's a negative or an unintended negative consequences, we should also be accountable and responsible and professionals in how do we address that situation.
How do the morals and values of advocates tie into their professional ethics?
Morals and values. And this is very important because in regards to morals and values, morals is the systems of community beliefs and values that determine in that community what is right and wrong. And we may vary in our personal values too. We might vary in terms of our beliefs, potentially, you know, about accepting gifts from those that we serve, discussing religion, maintaining certain relationships with our clients beyond a professional relationship. However, those may come into conflict with each other or compete, you know, for priority. However, I always like to mention that as it relates to ethics, which are basically our moral values in action, and ethics dictate our practical behaviors to create the standard which we operate. I believe, and I like to mention, that our professional values should be priority, because though the values and the morals that we may have as individuals in our community may, in occasion, could compete for priority when advocating on behalf of others.
So we're approaching our close, but I think we do have a little time for one other point of discussion, and I think this is very important. Let's talk a bit about cultural competency. What does that mean?
Great. That's so happy you brought that up, because that is a discussion or a subject that I like to talk about. So basically, cultural competency is the ability of individuals and organizations to understand, to respect, and effectively communicate with people from diverse cultures and backgrounds. Remember, when we're advocating on behalf of those who have experienced crime, adversity, or trauma, we work with people, we provide services for individuals that may come from different walks of life, from different cultures, and that is okay. Now, cultural competency in the context of advocacy means that we have the cultural competency, then understanding it is essential for effective engagement with the communities that we serve and also with our stakeholders. Per se, cultural competency requires advocates to have an understanding of the diversity of the community that we serve. Not only to have that understanding, but also to understanding different cultures, different languages, different beliefs, and different values that individuals may hold, which may be very dear to them. As advocates, we must respect the diversity of those communities. For us advocates, being culturally competent requires us to value those different perspectives and experiences of other individuals that shape their view of the world and recognize that diversity is a strength. Cultural competency requires us to use appropriate language to consider different cultural norms and ensuring that the information that we are about to share is, or that we are sharing, it's accessible to every single individual.
What a great discussion, sir. What a great discussion. What is one takeaway that you'd want our listeners to leave with today?
A couple of thoughts. First and foremost, always put victims first. That as advocates, we must prioritize the public interest or any potential personal or interest of an organization or an agency. As advocates, we are required to be always professional and act on the best interest of those that we serve, that we are mindful about the work that we do and always think about how can we be the very best for those that need us. Last, I'd like to mention a quote by John Maxwell, which is, if we are growing, we're always going to be out of our comfort zone. And doing this work, doing advocacy, on many occasions, we will be out of our comfort zone, but that's where growing is. And we should always be present for the good and the bad, that the world has, especially for those who are going through trauma, who have suffered adversity, and who have been victimized.
Wow, what a profound way to end today's episode. Mr. Palacios, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this very helpful information with our listeners. Thank you, listeners, for listening, and have an amazing day. Stay resilient. Thank you for joining this month's Resilience Roundup podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please continue to follow the Directorate of Prevention, Resilience, and Readiness on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay resilient.